Welcome to the Backend Engineering Show with your host, Hussein Nasser. This is the show where we discuss the art and the craft of building software and cover recent news on backend technologies. If you enjoy the show, make sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel and rate it on Spotify and Apple Podcast. With that said, let's get on the show. How's everybody doing this fine morning? We're gonna make this live stream short. It's gonna be about backend engineering theme. So ask any questions you want about the backend. Don't ask me about the front end because I don't know much about that. But let's have some discussions. Let's just drink our coffee, drink your favorite beverage, and let's just have fun. How about you guys? What is everybody doing? What is the best backend track for front-end engineer to become a full-stack engineer? Wow, that's a loaded question for the morning. Okay. So for a front-end engineer to become a full-stack engineer, so that's the path that you're looking at. In order to become a full stack engineer, I look at full stack engineering as something you start with, to be honest, something you get started with. And why? Because in the first year or two, you guys start to taste different things, right? Because as a full stack engineer, and most front end engineers, from what I saw online, actually kind of have the full stack property where they build their backend. They don't build it as a great backend, but they do build a backend. They build the database. So when you do that part, when you build the whole stack, you get to experience almost everything. Not really. There are some certain, well, it depends what you're building, but certain layers you're omitting for productivity reasons. Like if you're building a development, if you're developing something in the developing stage, you're not going to implement reverse proxies, right? Probably not, unless you're actually testing a reverse proxy. So yeah, as a front-end engineer, you got to test everything. As a full-stack engineer, you got to test all that stack. And when you do that, you will see what you gravitate to. You will see what you like and what you don't like. And then most front-end engineers end up being full stack engineers from what I see personally. And most full stack engineers, when they start as full stack engineer, either gravitate towards front end or towards the back end. And even if you do that, you go to the back end, you get to pick from a flower garden of what exactly you want to be as a backend engineer. Same thing applies to the front-end engineer. What exactly you want to become in the front-end engineer? What are you experienced at? Are you a browser? Are you good in the browser? Are you good what is this thing that's called the proxy layer that they added in the browser? I keep forgetting what it's called. Yeah, service something. Right, so whether you want to do that or go to mobile, all that's kind of front-end engineering, right? Even the word front-end versus back-end, it only applies to client-server architecture where you have a back-end to consume from a front-end. And you can see this pattern repeating everywhere. Even in the back-end, we have a front-end and a back-end. And even in the back-end, and the back-end, we have a front-end and a back-end. Constantine, how are you doing? Martin, what's up? Nelson says, hi, Hussein. I like your videos. Thanks, Nelson. I appreciate you. Please explain asynchronous event in JavaScript versus callback to a 10-year-old kid. I remember the joke from The Office. I don't know if you guys watch The Office, but it's one of my favorite shows, The Office US. So there is this episode, and it's called The Surplus, and Oscar comes in. There's no spoiler, but Oscar comes in and he's trying to explain a surplus to Michael. And Michael didn't understand anything he said. He says, like, why don't you explain to me like I'm an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old? Then he started explaining a little bit with different vocabularies, but he said, why do you explain it to me like I'm 5? That meme gets me every time. So yeah, how do you explain asynchronous JavaScript versus callback? So I'm gonna explain this in a sense of a single-threaded application. So think about it this way: when you have a callback, it acts very, very similar to asynchronous events loop. It's all the same thing. So you're talking about a causal and effect. An asynchronous loop, right? The event loop, and we have the callbacks, which is an effect of as a result. We have the promises, which is just a pretty version of what callbacks is. To my knowledge, obviously, I'm not a JavaScript expert engineer on how it was built, but that's what I understand. So there's something called the event loop, and what JavaScript is a single threaded app. There is a single main thread, right? That's not entirely true in Node.js, but let's assume it is. Okay, so JavaScript takes care of different properties, and there is an infinite loop that just goes over and over and over again. That's what the thread does. And every time this thread loops, there are things that this thread checks. Literally, it's just like while one, if you want to build it, there's a curly brace. And then the first thing it checks for events from the DOM, the document object management, DOM. What does DOM stand for? Oh my God, I forgot everything. Document object model. Sheesh. All right. So it checks if there are events, like on click, if someone clicked. And then it checks if there is someone actually submitted a function. Okay. And if there is a function submitted, it checks, is this function synchronous? And we talked about synchronous versus asynchronous. Check out the video, guys. Just search synchronous versus asynchronous Hussein. You're going to find it. So if there's a synchronous function that, I don't know, it does. It calculates a prime number. That thread going to be busy doing that. So anything after that has going to wait. So that's why when you have a function that has a very expensive compute in the browser and you clicked on a button, that button doesn't get clicked. It just freezes. Why? Because the event loop didn't have the time to jump back to actually serve you the on-click event. So that's one example of how the event loop actually works. So callbacks, what happens with callbacks is you execute a function, and if you say, hey, call me, don't actually do the result right now. Execute the result on the background, and when you get a result, call me back on this function. So what happens here is that the thread, instead of synchronously be busy just executing that thing, it's now have the option to execute it on the background. That's another thing that the main thread does, which is, okay, let me execute this asynchronous function. So it's going to execute it, and then it's going to move on and have the CPU thread. So there is a difference between the software thread and the CPU thread. Okay, but we're talking about the software thread when I say thread here. So it's going to take, okay, go move on and do the other things. It's called time slicing. It slices the time. So even if you decided to do a loop, right, to calculate the prime number asynchronously, you will have, instead of being blocked, right, you will have time sliced. That work is going to be slower, nevertheless, because you have a single thread. but it's going to start doing all that stuff in a time slice, man. So, okay, so maybe it's going to loop 100,000 times and then just go serve some events and then go back and do some other stuff and then go another 100,000. So it's going to start time slicing its work. Okay, this is different than Node.js, for instance, where you're reading from a disk or you're sending a network call, like a fetch API call, right? That is a little bit different. Let's explain that a little bit. You ask very, very tough question in the beginning of the meeting. Who asked this? I need to credit you. It's a good question. I like it. I think I missed that. But yeah, it's a great question regardless. So when you send that request, like you send a REST API call from the JavaScript, the client is not doing literally anything, right? Browser is not doing anything. It's just waiting. So that's the best thing for the browser. It's not actually doing compute. It sends the request. All of does have to do is like establish the TCP connection. If it doesn't exist, that's work. And then do the TLS handshake. That's a little bit of work. That's cryptography. That's encryption. That's a little bit of work. And then after that, it does. And maybe browsers do that in other threads. I'm not sure, right? But I'm giving you the simplest thing that I would have built, right? Or like a ghetto version of a browser, right? With a single thread. So what you're going to do is that TLS, and then once you have TLS, you have a connection, and then you have to start building the HTTP call, GET, so you have some string manipulation. If you have HTTP2, tough luck, that's even more work because you have to actually, the browser have to do streams, have to build a stream. If each stream has headers, so there's a little bit more work on HTTP, especially with CPU usage. That actually proves that this is happening in the C++ library in the browser. I'm talking about Chrome. Chrome is built in C++, right? So that happening outside JavaScript. When you write your code, you just send a request. But all of this work happening on that, so that might actually be multi-threaded. So it's a very complex question, right? Where are you? You, as a front-end engineer, you have access to a single stinking thread. That's it. You don't have access to all the beauty stuff. Unless you're building WASM, WebAssembly, then you're golden. You will have access to the browser will execute your WebAssembly code, whether you compile it from Go, from C++. That's a different story. So yeah, so in a fetch request, you don't really wait. You just send it. You wait, but you don't actively spend time blocking waiting. That's the best callback. So when you send a request, you just do your own thing. That event loop does exactly the same thing. Hey, do I have a result back? Did I get a result back? Nope. Once you actually get a result from the server, the operating system will do its TCP stack thingy and then will light up an event, and then the C++ thing and browser will push that event and then writes a callback function and calls actually say, hey, there is a callback. It doesn't call it. The event loop, the next time it loops back, oh, there's a callback. I have to actually execute it. And it executes it. And that's when your code actually gets light up. Oh, someone just called my callback function. That is exactly similar to how promises work. It's just syntactical sugar. Okay, so that's how it works. Hi, Sam. I'm working as a software engineer, mostly front end, but I want to switch to back end side in my company. Guide me what I should do. Start. If you have back end infrastructure, and I assume you do in your company, then start just hanging out with the back end engineer, I guess, and start just showing interest. And most of the time, you'll be surprised if you ask your manager, hey, I'm interested in the back end, I no longer want to be a front end engineer. Again, nothing wrong with being a front-end engineer at all. It just comes down to interest. So yeah, and start actually showing your skills. If you know the back-end, just try to build something and try to identify the problems in the back-end. So do research, ask questions, all that stuff. Sikkar says, do you think WebRTC will make Zoom obsolete? Zoom as the app? Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't even know how Zoom architecture works. Did they actually explain it in a blog? I'd like to make a video about it. But I know it's not peer-to-peer, definitely. Zoom is not peer-to-peer. Otherwise, you cannot have 100 people in a call. That's just impossible. But WebRTC gives you a nice API. And guys, what do you think about WebRTC video? I enjoyed making that video. That was good. This might be a dumb question, but what font do you use on your thumbnail? I love the way you look. Oh, thank you. Not dumb at all. I found that font. I'm actually opening Canva. Canva, by the way, a lot of people ask me, how do you make your thumbnail? I'm not a Photoshop designer. I know nothing about Photoshop. I never opened Photoshop in my life. Maybe once in the university back, 19 years ago. That's the last time I opened Photoshop. I don't know anything about Photoshop. So the font is, I use Canva for everything. Really, I pay around $120 a year, and I get access to all these fancy logos. And for the longest time, I can build the thumbnail on my phone, all that stuff. Obviously, they're not sponsored or anything like that. But what's the font? It's called Adumo Regular. Adumo Regular. Let me type it in. Adumo Regular. 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 I don't know if you're going to find it, though. That's the font name. I just typed it in the chat. Lakshay, thank you for the 50 rupees. Appreciate it. Appreciate the support. And guys, don't feel blushed to do super chats at all. Just hanging out, just watching my content. You just being here is all what I need. Really appreciate you guys. Vato, hi Hussein. I'm trying to figure out why I'm getting 502 bad gateway errors on my server. To clarify, I'm getting 502 from other service used on my server. Any tips? So 502, let me remember that. I think it's a gateway error, right? 502A gateway error, okay. 502, don't look at the blogs when you say 502. 502 bad gateway. So this is an HTTP error, obviously, right? And when the fact that you got response back, think about, I want you to understand this thing, guys. A lot of people don't understand what's going on when they get these kind of errors. They think something is broken. You have so much clue when they give you this error, right? When you connect to a reverse proxy. I'm very 100% sure that you have a reverse proxy when you get a 502 error gateway. Nginx tells you a little bit more errors, but HAProxy give you 502 unless your web server somehow returns 502. Most of the time you have a reverse proxy. Okay, you make a request to the reverse proxy. Reverse proxy usually does not serve content, but sometimes it does, but usually it does not, right? It relies on some backend, other backend. Let me do it this way so you can see. The client sends the reverse proxy, and the reverse proxy is sent to a backend. And the backend services actually respond back to the reverse proxy, and actually the reverse proxy responds back. So this is the chain that we're looking at. And this could happen infinite amount of time. The other backend service could be other reverse proxies for another backend service. That's why microservices are very complicated. So now this is the architecture. You're getting a 502 error. The fact that you're actually getting an error from the reverse proxy, that tells me that the reverse proxy is happy. It's great, right? Because it managed to respond to you with content, and the content happened to be an error. Who cares? But once you understand that, you understand that, okay, there is I sent a request to the reverse proxy. The reverse proxy tried to communicate to the backend. Usually when it couldn't, whether the backend is unavailable or the backend took too long to respond, that's a different error, by the way. Usually the generic error says gateway error. The backend crashed, or you have some problem with your reverse proxy rules that the reverse proxy doesn't know where to forward the request to. So again, this you get only this error, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, in layer 7 proxy. in layer four proxying, if you can't reach out the back end, I think you're just gonna get the loading error in the browser says, hey, just wait. See, I almost missed it. Yeah, no, you didn't. We just started. Don't worry. We just started. I tried to do a schedule this time. I don't know, guys. Did the scheduling help you to actually find the content, find the live stream? Because I'm trying to live stream every Saturday. And now the time, it really depends on my family. So I'm not sure. So it could be 7, could be 9 PST. And today I stream at 7 because we have to do some other stuff to take care of it. Please, can you explain dependency inversion and app context? I don't know what's that. Sorry, Nelson. I don't know what dependency inversion is. How can you discover and dig technology like your videos? Muhammad asked, how do you discover and dig technologies like your videos? I mean, how do you research, basically? It takes time, really. You see a fully polished video, but you don't see the work behind how much hours spent to actually make that video, right? And I'm talking about not just the hours spent to make that dedicated video. I'm talking about the built-in compound interest of knowledge that you built. Because as you learn more knowledge and you acquire new knowledge, you start building on the old knowledge. And once you have that, you're unstoppable. Because you're building on a solid foundation. Once you understand the first principle, everything can be built so easily. It's like a Lego blocks. If you have a weak base and then you start building on top of it, it falls apart because you start adding new pieces and says, wait a second, I don't understand what this means, right? Because so the moment it falls apart, that means you have a weak infrastructure. And I'm explaining this a little bit emphatically, but think about it as an actual idea. So that's basically my process is it takes me a long time to do a research. That's why the WebRTC is a good example. It took me a long time to actually sit down and do the research for WebRTC. It took almost 2 years. But when I say 2 years, I didn't spend 24 hours a day, 365 days researching WebRTC. No, I went into rabbit holes. That comes back to the collateral knowledge. Check out the collateral knowledge. I'm going to type it here. Collateral knowledge. I hope I spelled it right. So collateral knowledge, just Google that. I think I'm still the only video that actually explained this in a human speak. Other videos, just a 40-hour lecture that I didn't understand anything from. So collateral knowledge is the idea of you want to learn Nginx or you want to learn Redux. Okay, I asked that the other day, Redux, a question front end. So you want to learn Redux. And in the process of learning Redux, you stumbled upon terminologies that you had no idea of. It's like, what the hell is a singleton design pattern? So you start doing, okay, singleton design pattern is a pattern where you get a single instance of a class, no matter where you call it from. It's a global model. It's like, oh, what the hell is a design pattern? And then you start learning about different design patterns. That's the fact of you're searching a single goal and you get collateral knowledge as a result for free. Not really for free, but you get it, right? You get it because you walking towards that goal. See ya. Thank you for the consistently great content. Thank you for the super chat. I appreciate you so much. Thank you. Appreciate it. What's the difference, Viraj? Viraj, you're a badass. I like all your comments. Thank you for the support and continuous comments and discussion. Good discussion point. What's the difference between a massage queue and a task queue? Ooh. So I would say that's a very interesting question. And I like that you actually try to make a difference between the two. It's a queue, right? Both of them, a task queue and and the message queue are the exact same, which is a queue. What is a queue? You go and you wait, and someone else comes behind you and wait. And so it's a first in, first in. Is that what I said? First in, last out. FIFO. First in, first out. Okay. Oh, I forgot about all that stuff. So first in, the one who first enters the queue, he will be first to be served, right? So or she. So the message queue. A message is a message. You add a message, which is a content, in the queue, and someone need to pop it off the queue to actually do something with that message. And once that message popped off the queue, and 100 times and processed, then you pop it off the queue. And that's the challenge that every message queue has. Exactly once guarantee, all that garbage that Kafka has, exactly once guarantee, at most once guarantee, all that, at least once guarantee, all these guarantees, because it's like, how do I know if I popped a message and I actually, the client didn't crash? Maybe they popped a message, but they crashed. That's why you have to acknowledge that you actually, hey, I got you. All done. So I actually process it. So feel free to pop it from the queue. So that's another topic of discussion. So that's a message. So the execution of what to do with the message is done externally. The task queue is usually a higher level concept. That's how I understand it, at least, where you submit a message, right, with input, compute function, and output, expected output. And you submit that structure to the queue, okay? And what happened here is when I, as a process, pop this task, this function from the queue, same exactly. To me, it's just a string. It's just a bunch of content, right? But I will process what you actually put as a function in the queue. I'll just process it. In the message queue, you have a little bit more freedom. You put the execution outside of the queue task. Now the task queue, has the actual execution function in it, right? That's how I understand it, at least, right? So the task queue is a more general case. Yeah, the message queue is a general case of a task queue. Task queue is just, yeah, it actually does more than just queuing. It actually executes the task, right? And when we execute the task, we talk about, okay, how many processes do you want to execute the tasks and all that stuff, right? All of that. I think Celery with RabbitMQ kind of work hand in hand, right? Because Celery does the execution while RabbitMQ does the storing of the message. Again, I might be wrong. Haven't looked at that for a long time. How to implement process-intensive task in Node.js like Mongo? Mongo image component. Why did I write it in Mongo? Oh, I'm getting old. I can't even read. How to implement process-intensive task in Node.js like image compression? Heard about C++ add-on Node.js, but don't know how to implement. I mean, why would you pick Node.js for such complex task? To me, I wouldn't pick JavaScript. Like, if it's a process intensive, you have to pick a language that, first of all, it's not garbage collection. It's not garbagely collected, right? Because you want to manage the memory yourself if you know what you're doing. So Rust, C++, C, if you're feeling brave. And that gives you almost meta level access to the CPU, right? So you have more access. Node.js is a very high level language. Plus it's a single threaded, right? Yeah, you can definitely spin up multiple processes and do all of that stuff, but I don't see it as a good idea to have Node.js execute expensive compute like that. It's not designed for that. Yeah, you can do it, but it's not designed for that. So if you have Node.js as a web server that accepts like traffic, have it does that job and that job only, and then offload that work to a C++ component. Now the trick is, how do you communicate between the C++ component and the Node.js? That's IPC. It's called IPC. What's it called? Remote procedural call. Musa, hello Hussein. Please, what is the effective way to build following RDBMS? Oh, that's a tough question. RDBMS, MTM, item quotation. I don't know. That's a tough question for live chat, man. It's not very clear. Maybe you can rephrase it, Musa. Sorry about that. Let's play PlayStation. Sure, would you actually watch me play and just chat about back engineering? I really doubt it. Good morning, Tariq. What's your opinion on real-time protocol, RTMP? Also interesting to know how lots of companies are adopting Quick. Yeah, it is very interesting that people are starting adopting Quick. Although it's just in draft mode. So they are just at the bleeding edge, right? Facebook, basically. We made that video about Facebook moving to Quick as a technology. It's a very interesting. It's a very, very interesting thing to learn that they are actually moving to Quick. And a lot of people are following that. When I say people, I mean companies, obviously. Real-time protocol, it's what live streaming works on. And I mean, we're live streaming, and that's the real-time protocol. What is it called? RTMP. I forgot what the M stands for. Real time. Guys, what does the M stand for? Can you guess? How dumb am I? Real time messaging protocol. So it's a protocol built on UDP for real time communication. Constantine, thank you for the $15 super chat. How much would you charge per hour for a one-to-one mentoring? A couple of hours a month to keep me helping accountable growth. I'm currently with a software developer in the US with a 5-year experience. I'm sorry, I don't do one-to-one mentoring. Not now, at least. But I'll let you know if that changes. I just don't have the time for it. But thank you for the super chat. Appreciate it. Having integer type auto increment primary key help in better indexing and fast DB reads. So auto increment is always a good idea because you let the database do the incrementation for you, right? So it's like it does the increment for you. The worst thing you can do is that you increment at the application level and you try to store that incrementation. Don't get me wrong, you have to do that sometime. You have to increment at the application. I built a lot of applications where there is no choice. The database understand the context to increment that correctly. Because I need to increment it in certain cases versus not, right? So, yeah. Obviously, it helps indexing because the moment you have a sorted thing in the database, databases love sorted stuff. So, yeah, they do. RMTP, real-time messaging protocol, of course. MQL messaging. I think it's under TCP based off Flash. Really, it's TCP? I would be surprised if it's TCP, dude. I think RTMP, the real-time protocol. You know what? I'll just make a video about this. I'll need to educate myself about this, right? Would like to see a tutorial on it. You're right. A tutorial on it will come soon, Sam. Pranto Hassan, you're a good guy. Love your video. Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. Hi again, Hussein from Italy. See ya. You're a regular. You're regular in chat. See ya. Thank you so much. Could you talk about the pros and cons of garbage collectors? From my experience, the applications I did wasn't consumed by millions and millions of users. So you don't feel garbage collection rearing its head and actually pausing your application. You do that if you're Google, Facebook, or Shopify scale, or garbage or Linkerd scale, or if your application is heavily trafficked, right? Then garbage collection becomes a real problem. But the problem here is garbage collection is is a very, very small chunk of the expense that get executed on any request. Very, very minimal. And usually it's once per 100 requests, right? And usually if you do a bad job at memory location, right, where things just happen to be like pull a memory location, then you have a lot of work that to actually free up memory, right? This doesn't happen in C++ because you have to manage your memory yourself. But if you're putting a lot of stuff in memory, big content in memory, and then all of a sudden you discard that, oh, garbage collection need to go and actually freeze the apps. It's app stop right there. Don't touch RAM until I clean up this mess that you created. So it goes and then clean up this mess. And during the cleanup, the app pauses for 100 millisecond, 50 millisecond. So that not much. If your request already takes like 500 millisecond, 600 milliseconds not going to be much, right? But if your request takes, I don't know, 20, 30 milliseconds, especially in a microservices, very tight environment where things are talking to each other, then 100 milliseconds is going to kill you, right? So you need to worry about that. But most of the time, for most of us, we don't have to worry about garbage collection, rearing its head. So pick a garbage collection language. Again, really depends. I keep coming up with this example where garbage collected languages, and there is a live example from Linkerd, Confluent, a company that built a service mesh, right? Service mesh, if you don't know, it's just a fancy term for reverse proxy. For both a reverse proxy and a proxy. Don't sweat it. That's what it is, right? And if you don't know what reverse proxy, check out my video, reverse proxy. So it's to communicate between two services, they put two extra layers on top of the services. And instead of communicating the services directly, they put a reverse proxy and a proxy to communicate between these two services. Now, if you think about it a little bit, instead of raw implementation, what I connect directly, now you added two hops. You better not add almost no latency when you do that. You might say, Hussein, why did we add two hops? Why did we add this? No, that's a different question. I made a video about service mesh sidecar pattern. Check out that video. But the idea here is to isolate the application from networking. That's the goal, right? Because we don't want the application to know about the protocol that we're communicating in so that we can easily upgrade it. So let's say you communicate in HTTP 1.1 between the services, and all of a sudden you want to upgrade to HTTP 2 or 3 or quick. What do? You have to rebuild your application so that it is aware of HTTP 1, and now you have to destroy the HTTP 1 library and upgrade to HTTP 2 library. Imagine all the bugs that you're going to get. Replacing code, copy and paste. What the heck was that? Replace and paste, all that stuff, so the application can suffer as a result. If you do it as a sidecar, then the application communicate with the reverse proxy as a local host. It's a loop back. It just loops back to itself. If the sidecar isn't the same host, you can put it in another host, but that's the bad idea. So, or the same container, right? That's called a sidecar container in that case. So they have the same loopback. So if you send the application, just sends back a request to the reverse proxy, to the sidecar, and the sidecar knows how to transfer this information back to the actual reverse proxy. In this case, it's called a proxy. If you send, you are a requester, and if the other side, it's called a reverse proxy, where it accepts the request and forwards it back to the client, which happens to be a backend service. It's an interesting technology. I loved it when I first heard about it. But so that's the sidecar proxy. So why start explaining about service mesh all of a sudden? Well, yes, because I wanted to, because one gentlewoman asked about a question about garbage collecting languages. So those guys, Linkerd, which built this service mesh, which is this thing that's always on the way, not to mention there is a control plane as well, they said they use Java, which is the worst language to use
when you are a proxy. Why? Because there's traffic going on all the time. Plus, the JVM is huge. I don't know, 200, 300 megs sometimes. Just to execute, you compute a lot of memory. Plus, it's a garbage collection language. So the more requests you receive, the more memory you're going to allocate, the more memory you need to garbage collect. And when that happens, the application pauses, says, guys, stop everything you're doing. I'm cleaning up, right? It's a cleaning up. I don't know why I'm making this sound. Start cleaning up. And when you clean up, you cannot do anything. It just freezes. And those freezes, you feel it in the request. So a request that takes a few milliseconds, now all of a sudden takes 150 milliseconds. That's much. Again, guys, that's when they said, oh, Java is a bad choice for this kind of application, for just that kind. We need to shift it back to, they built it using Rust. So it's no longer a garbage collecting language, but I say build it, but it's a hard problem. The Rust wasn't popular back when they did that 3-4 years ago. So that's one choice where they move from a garbage collection to a non-garbage collected language. But you don't have to worry about it if you're building, I don't know, a REST API most of the time, right? So short answer, that wasn't short at all. Short answer is build an app. It depends on your app. If your app had heavily trafficked and it's very low latency and garbage collection is actually killing you, then you move to a non-garbage collection. But again, it really depends. Hi, Hussein. Carlos says, hi, Hussein. Excellent channel and great information as always. Appreciate you, sir. How about Golang to implement a proxy? So here's where it gets a little political, right? Golang is being used by a lot of applicants. I mean, I know Kadi uses Golang, but I'm yet to see Kadi in production as a proxy. I have not seen anyone uses Kadi as a production. And when I ask the developer, sometimes Matt Hull, he's a smart engineer, but he doesn't take any criticism lightly. He shuts you off. But he's smart. So when I ask, it's like, yeah, he's like, do I have any Kadi customers so I can look, because I want input, right? And we want, he said, well, the people who uses Kadi don't want to tell others that they use Kadi. I was like, okay, that's weird. But yeah, Go is a garbage collection language, but I know garbage collection, Go as a garbage collection, is they did so much improvement that I need to read on to improve garbage collection itself so it doesn't actually pose, right? I don't know much about it, but again, I need to see numbers. I didn't see any numbers with Go as a reverse proxy, right? That's why people don't pick Go. You pick it as when your latency doesn't really gives you that much, right? Differences. But yeah. But I need to make a video about Kadi 2. I made a video about Kadi 1. I need to talk about Kadi 2 as a web server. And you guys know my opinion when it comes to something that does everything, right? Kadi does a web server, a great web server, a secure web server. That if they stopped here, I'll be happy about this service. But they also claim to be a reverse proxy. They claim to be a sidecar. They claim to be an ingress controller. Guys, really? How can you do possibly all that? You don't have the funds, first of all, to do all of that. And even if you do, how can you improve all of that stuff at once? This is a completely different problem. Being a proxy, being a web server is completely different. And people freak out when I see that. A lot of people disagree with me, but that's just an opinion. That's my opinion. If I'm going to pick a proxy, I'm going to either build it from scratch or pick something that is purely a proxy. Example, a JProxy. Nginx is doing great job as a reverse proxy because it was built a long time ago. Plus, it's built in C++, so there's no garbage collection. So that's another point. Yeah, traffic. Traffic is a Golang reverse proxy. That's a good example. How is traffic doing in the cloud? Maybe it's doing great. Maybe I'm wrong. Of course. I might be wrong. How are you saying? I'm thinking about a career
orientation change. Do you have some advice to start as a cloud architect career? Cloud architect. So if you think about cloud architect, I've heard about this term, but I understand why it exists, because cloud architecture is a little bit different from normal architecture, because cloud architecture is, you have to worry about security compared to enterprise architecture, where you're kind of secured internally, right? I mean, you can still secure, but you're not worrying about security when it comes to, yes, you do worry about security, but in cloud, it's public, right? In enterprise, nobody can access you. It's behind NATs and all that stuff. So I would focus on security when it comes to cloud architecture, in my opinion, and networking, obviously. Small application with very small traffic can be monolithic. And if you don't see huge traffic in the near future, consider monolithic. I agree with that statement. Yeah, if you don't need microservices, stick to monolithic. Only do it when those big guys actually, they only needed to go to microservices because they absolutely need to. Tarek said, could you explain GeoDNS or round-robin DNS? So GeoDNS and round-robin DNS, let's talk about them a little bit. Let's sip some water and think about GeoDNS. So those are all fancy names. What is DNS first? What is DNS? DNS is a service, runs on UDP. Not if it's a DOH, but on top of, if it's DOH, that's a different story. But it runs on UDP, and you give it a new domain, and it tells you the IP address so that you actually can establish a TCP connection to that IP address. And the trick here is, what IP address should it give you? If I go to google.com in India, actually type google.com in India, and I type google.com in California, I'm going to get two different IP addresses. Why? Because the request that the DNS request from India to the DNS query, will the DNS provider will know, oh, this IP is coming from India. Let us give them a Google IP address that is the closest to India. It could be in India, it could be in somewhere in Asia, and that the IP address you deliver. So that's called that's called a spatial proximity, right? GeoDNS and other names. So based on your geography, you receive an IP address that is very closest to you. And how do you know that? Because when you send a UDP request to actually ask for the DNS, you put your source IP address there, right? It's a packet. Source IP is going to be your IP. The destination IP is going to be the DNS IP address, which is in, if it's Cloudflare, is going to be 1111. If it's Google, it's going to be 8888. If it's your ISP, is going to be something fancy that as your ISP, so they can look at what you're searching. So that's GeoDNS. The other thing. Wow, we've been streaming for 54 minutes. Wow. Okay, time flies with you guys. I love you guys. Time flies. All right. So what else? What is the other thing you said? Oh, round robin DNS. That's the round robin DNS is the most important DNS when it comes to high availability and active clustering. We talked about active versus active passive. Check out the videos on that. If you want to search anything, just type Hussein or active the topic, and then type Hussein after that, so you can find my content. Usually I talk about most of the stuff. If I talk about something, I usually stumbled upon it, but in order to stumble upon it, I had to search a lot of stuff and make videos about a lot of stuff in order to reach that. So active, or before we do active, round robin is, there is in the DNS, there is a record called SRV record, which is a service record. And it can contain multiple IP addresses. And why, you might say? Because you can make a DNS request to Google and get one IP address. And if you make the same DNS request to Google, you're going to get another IP address. Why? That's a perfect round-robin load balancing. So that you don't send all the people
making requests going to google.com to the same machine running IP address, right? Whether this machine happened to the actual web server or happened to be the reverse proxy. That's why what they do for true active cluster, high availability cluster, they put two reverse proxies. This has IP address, let's say 6666, and this IP address 7777, right? And there, behind this reverse proxy, the first one, there is, I don't know, 300 services, web servers. And behind this reverse proxy, there is 400 services. So now, when you go to yourservers.com, let's say, I'm going to call it Tariq Ali. Is that your last name, Ali? I hope I didn't butcher that. TariqAli.com. DNS provider has the service record of 2, 6666 and 7777. So if someone made a request, it goes to this active to this cluster, to the reverse proxy, because that's what the IP address is. So the internet does a job and drops you right there. And then once it sees that and goes to one of the services based on the layer 7 round robin or any load balancing algorithm that the reverse proxy is configured at. If you make another request, you might go to a completely different reverse proxy, 777, and that does also a round robin. And that could go infinite amount of time to another reverse proxy, to another reverse proxy, to another reverse proxy until it reaches the actual backend service that actually consumes or returns the result to you. Make sense? Oh, Tariq Ali, yes. So that makes sense? Makes sense? So that's basically it. So this architecture, if you build something like that, your application better be stateless. If it's not stateless, the whole architecture is going to flip, right? Because guess what? You make a fetch command to 6666, all right, to TariqAli.com, gives you the IP address, and then you go to one server, and then you put a state on one of the machines there. And then you make another request, I don't know, to the same TariqAli.com, now gives you another IP address, gives you another server, and you're looking for that state. That just destroys your architecture. So that's when you need to be smart about, I'm not saying stateful is bad, right? But if you want to do this, then you have to be stateless. So make sure the request have every single thing it needs when you actually send it so that it doesn't rely on a state stored in a server. So it's not stateful. That's not always the case because sometimes you need to build an application in a stateful manner to save some cycles and get a much, much better performance. And that's when you get into sticky sessions and all that jazz. But sticky session is going to be very tricky to manage at the DNS level. I have no idea how we're going to do that. Jetin said, is it outdated to use PM2 on a VM over using Docker containers? What is PM2? Isn't PM2 that Node.js thingy that spins up multiple processes? Unless I'm missing something here. But PM2 is on a single machine. Oh, okay. Now we're in the same page. So PM2 is the app that spins up multiple services, I guess, huh? On the same machine versus Docker container. I don't see a difference, to be honest. So if you use PM2 on the same machine, that just works on a single VM or a single machine, right? Docker containers, you can spin up multiple Docker containers. But if it's still in the same machine, you can do that. I don't know if there is a tool that actually does that for you, a PM2 at the container level. To be honest, I don't see a value. Just use PM2 on your VM. Yeah. The problem when you move to Docker containers, you have to orchestrate them between two machines. And for that, either write your own script or use Kubernetes, which is an overkill for most people. Brian Lopez, thanks for sharing your knowledge. Greeting from Guatemala. I was drinking Guatemalan coffee last week. This one today is from Peru. Appreciate you, Brian. Cluster mode in Node.js. Yes, there is a cluster mode in Node.js, I believe. I never used it, though. It was another good question. Can you talk, Abdurrahman says, can you talk about microservices design pattern pros and cons? I made a video about that. check it out if you want to learn more about them. Just say microservices Hussein. You're going to see the video. I actually talk about the pros and cons. But in a nutshell, we'll see. So microservices, see if I can nail it. So microservices, the idea here is, what is microservices, right? Before we jump into microservices, the idea here is I build one application and I have methods. I have a function. I have a class in the same app. And I call a method on that class. And all of that is built within the linker, right? The operating system linker that links everything. And it goes into one machine. And that machine actually goes in, the whole functions are all cached in the RAM. And if I call a function, it's just literally a silicon call. It's just the whole thing is electric, I think. Yeah, you can say it's electric, electronic. Everything is electronic, and you can call the function very quickly. You cannot get any quicker than silicon. That's unless we figure out quantum, right? So that's, if I call a function, it's in the same application. You call, I don't know, hello world or any function. If it's in the same application, that's the best thing. Yeah. The problem with having functions in the same app is you get two people, two developers managing the same code base in this case, right? I mean, you can argue that you can put this into a different project and reference them in DLLs or SOs or whatever, referencing or linking DLL, right? Or linking library, any concept like that. You can do that, but still, it's going to, when the app load is going to all load in memory, yeah, some of them will lazily load, but it's still, at the same time, all of them is the same machine, same silicon, it's the faster. The problem here is the communication. The problem here is I have to use the same language, right? Between, if I want to call a function in Go, this function also has to be written in Go. .NET, C Sharp, this has to be C Sharp. That's not entirely true because you can build a DLL in VB.NET and you can build a different project in C Sharp and still communicate with each other. That's the beauty of .NET, right? But that's a framework. There's a layer there that does all that stuff for you. But regardless, so take my word for it. You have to use the same language. A lot of people don't like that. Another thing is team management, right? It's like, okay, this team want to use this certain database versus this team want to use this certain database. You can't. You have to use this is singleton database, and everybody has to agree because this the client also uses the same needs to use this database. So there's a lot of things that some problems that people found with the monolithic approaches, which we talk about, right? Plus, when you put a lot of stuff, speaking of monolith, if you put a lot of method, a lot of function in single application, and you spin it up, it takes time, right? Because whether you want to use function A, B, C, D, you don't get the choice. You're gonna get all of them when you spin up the application, right? There are some compiler optimization that you do if you are advanced that actually don't load certain function if you're not going to use them and lazily load them. But that's advanced stuff. You can do all sorts of advanced stuff. Facebook does this all the time with PHP, right? So slow to start. Have to use the same language. There are some restrictions and other stuff as well. So people said, okay, we're going to use microservices and we're going to break them up. So the moment you break things up, first of all, I'm going to talk about the cons. You slow things down because now this function becomes a service. You have to listen on a port because how else are you going to communicate, right? You have to listen on a network port. So that's some network. You have networking knowledge, right, that you didn't have to worry about before, right? You might argue that I'm not going to use ports, I'm going to use inter-process communication. Well, still, things that you didn't have to do, now you have to do it. So that's the first thing. You have to have networking libraries on both sides. The function and the function that calls it, right? So that's the first thing. That slows things down develop in the development process because I have to implement this stuff. And the second problem is, what if I decide to upgrade this logic, right? What if I decide to upgrade this library to communicate to something other, other protocol, then from TCP to UDP or from HTTP to HTTP2, you have to rewrite the logic here. This is where Service Mesh came and says, oh, guys, let's isolate that. So to me, what happened with microservices, we had almost no problem or very little problem, and we tried to be so fancy, we broke everything into microservices, and we created double or not even triple the amount of problems. But now, to me, microservices created more problems. And the more problem it creates, people come in and try to solve the problems that the microservices created that didn't exist before. That's what's nuts about the whole thing. It's nuts, guys. So another problem is, like, when you want to debug a monolithic application, what do? You put a breaking point and you run your application and everything in RAM, so you can essentially stop and debug everything you want, whether it's a function, different function from another class. If it's another project, you just add that project to the linker and then all of a sudden it shows up and you can debug it. Guess what? You cannot do that in microservices. Once you send that request, it's gone from your application. How the hell would you debug that? So now people, oh guys, we're going to solve this problem for you. Yeah, first of all, we're going to put service meshes, and the service mesh, well, what we're going to do, we're going to put something called tracing. So now we have invented a new term that we didn't need before called open tracing. And there's all sort of application called distributed tracing. So now I don't blame anyone that jumps into this field and says, what the heck are you guys doing? Distributed tracing, so you can, when you send a request, because now we have to go through 700 hops, how the heck I trace this request into its server? Previously, it's a debug. Oh, just debug it to follow it, and the compiler does everything for me, right? Well, the runtime, at least, does that for me. But you cannot do that. So they invented solutions to solve problems created by this architecture. Again, I might seem a little bit negative when it comes to microservices. That's because people took it to the extreme, and that's my beef with the whole thing. We're solving problems that didn't exist. So if you're Mike's donut shop, why the heck do you need microservices? Just spin up a WordPress app and then do your thing. You don't need microservices. If you're selling carpets, right? Why do you need microservices? So my point is, we're over-engineering things, and as a result, we create problem. And when we create this problem, we try to solve these problems that we actually created that we didn't have before. Guys, I want to focus what we did here. To do this, that's the cons. The pros of the microservices, now we have a lighter version. The service does one thing and one thing only. So that's sexy when we talk about it. Oh, my services are sexy. They're lightweight. They spin up fast, which is very attractive to me. I like it. I like if the service takes 20 milliseconds to start. Oh my God, this is good. But is it worth me investing on? Oh my God, I didn't even talk about Kubernetes. Now we have, how many services do we have? Now we have two services. Let's say you have a lot of functions and you decided to break them even finer, which is a bad idea, by the way. A lot of people talk about the macro services now instead of micro services. So yeah, instead of breaking your monolithic every single function into a microservice or a group of functions into microservice, do a macro services where just like, okay, still keep things that are chatty next to each other and keep things that are chatty next to each other and things that barely talk to each other, let them talk through the service. That's fine. That if you do it right, you can actually get really, really good things. So yeah, Tracing can be achieved by stitching logging a transaction ID. So yeah, that's what you do. Basically, you give a transaction ID or a request ID for every request that you make, and you can trace it. I'm not saying something is wrong with that. I'm questioning, why do you need it in the first place? Don't break everything up, right? And the moment you start breaking up a lot of services, now how do you scale? Well, scaling became easier because, hey, I can just spin up multiple services very easy, right? But now, how do you load balance these things? Well, you have to put a reverse proxy. Okay. You have to put this thing called service discovery. Okay. That's another overhead. Then all of a sudden you have to spin up. You cannot put all of this in one machine, because the moment you put this in one machine, then if that machine goes down, your entire application and all of these services just goes down with it. Docker or not, doesn't matter. If you have 300 Docker containers running on a single machine, that machine dies, everything dies, right? So now you have to put another VM with the same architecture. Now you have duplicated your work. The nasty things you had to do here, you had to do it over again. So now people came in and says, to the rescue, Kubernetes, something, or Mesos before that. Let me orchestrate that for you. I'll take care of all that beautiful stuff for you. So you just put another architecture on top of it. And after that, I'm just lost. It's like, there is no coming back from this. The media is running of this. The marketing, everybody's just promoting Kubernetes. And all the ads on Twitter, what do you see? Oh, learn Kubernetes in 3 days. Learn Gateway, API Gateway. Learn my... Now, yeah, we created a lot of jobs, I guess, but do we really need that for everybody? Probably not. For the cloud, if someone is managing all of that stuff for me, I might bite. But the inner engineer in me doesn't feel content, let's say, to not understand what the heck is going on. It just feels really wrong, right? Again, I might be just a conspiracy theorist. Why is it called a VM when it's an actual machine? Well, a virtual machine, you can put multiple virtual machines in a single physical machine. Love the take. Again, guys, you can do free think for yourself, right? It's just, this is my take. I want you to think about everything. Ask why, right? Before jumping into anything, right? And sometimes it makes sense. Sometimes it doesn't, right? I'm not being just negative about microservices just for the sake of it. If it makes sense, obviously. Right? For Google, if they don't have microservices, they will not scale, because they are Google. They receive billions of requests a day. Twitter, the same thing. I don't believe Twitter has microservices. They still use VMs, by the way. That might have changed, because I listened to a podcast that actually used VMs. When to use RPC, RabbitMQ over HTTP? RPC, request a remote procedural call over HTTP? Well, remote procedural call is a generic term where you can call a remote function through sockets, right? Whether the socket is UDP, TCP, or any other medium, carrier pigeon, doesn't matter, right? You can put a pigeon that delivers your request to other machine, and that machine takes that pigeon and then gets the message and then executes it. That's also through RPC. But HTTP is it's just a protocol that allows RPC. So you can say that HTTP is RPC. Some people will yell at me if they hear me say that, because HTTP is a request response system. Roy Fielding, the creator, what's the difference between API and gRPC? Oh, these are this. API is a generic term. RPC. Oh, not gRPC. You're talking about RPC. Remote procedural call is when you have a function and you want to execute that function remotely. API is when you have a set of API, a very uniform thing, right? application programming interface that serves a certain amount of thing, and then that defines it. So API is a backend thing, RPC is a communication thing. You can build an API on top of RPC if you want to. You can build an API on top of any protocol. What do you think about data structures interviews? Data structure interview. Well, it depends what you're interviewing for. I think they are mostly BS, in my opinion, because the interviewer will just throw at you what they learned in school, probably. And they say, okay, do a quick sort, which is completely useless question, in my opinion, right? Because you can memorize that and then go, right? But this is something known. To me, a good interview question would be an open-ended question that makes you actually, you cannot actually look it up. If I say, if you would build Facebook front-end, for example, just pick one niche, how would you build it? Just throw him under the bus like that. That will be a very interesting answer, because it's like, oh, what do you mean? What do you mean this? If you will see if someone is knowledgeable or not, because they will start asking you back questions. I'm talking about as an interviewer, right? They will start asking you back questions. And they ask you back questions, then you know what kind of quality of questions they ask, and you can kind of gauge their knowledge. And you can make your decision as a result. But data structure questions are good if you're interviewing for, I don't know, you're building the Neuralink for Elon Musk. That thing is going to be a complete different thing that we never built before. So data structures are important. So you might invent a new data structure that we didn't see before to build that thing that will allow to control our brains in the future. JWT in 1 minute. It's a token that has everything in it. It's a stateless token. Basically, the server generates it, and you don't need a server to verify it. You don't need the same server to verify that token. Anyone can verify it. Obviously, this is great, but it also has a lot of security concerns. What if the way the private key generated that token as it got leaked, or what if the token turns out to be shady and we know you want to invalidate that token? There's no way to do that because you don't have a centralized server that tells you this is bad anymore. You have to create other measures, and that's another example of how we basically complicate things in software engineering. We had a problem. We had session ID. The problem with sessions is we always had to refer to the same server to authenticate ourselves, right? So it's a centralized system. We wanted to create a decentralized server by creating the JSON web token, by having everything in the token itself. Yeah, it solved the problem. Now I can send this everywhere, and this server doesn't have to come back and validate the centralization. But once we verify it, you're good. However, there are still problems where what if this a bad token? Got stolen, something like the key, the corresponding key got stolen. Plus, you have to share the key, and now we have to have a public-private key token validation or symmetric key token validation, and then you have the key management aspect of you're managing keys instead of having a centralized server. So, and instead of doing all of that stuff, you have to worry about JSON web token libraries. So it creates double amount of the work, right? So there's one PhD guy that just specialized in JWT and what's the best practice of web. And that job was created because of JWT. It didn't exist before. Most of the problems with that JWT created didn't exist before, because you had a centralized server to authenticate with. And if you want to invalidate a session, easy. Go to the SQL, delete that session, all done. But now, you had to come back to a centralized system anyway. So the JWT went and come back to the same thing, which is centralized server. Now we have centralized server. Or you have to create all this hack, refresh token, and What's the other thing? Access token. Sometimes I swear to God, I think we like to just complicate our life for no reason at all. JW2 versus Passport. I never used Passport. How do you solve secret zero problem in microservices? What is a secret zero problem? I never heard about that. Sucker. What if a new certificate authority needs to be introduced? A new root certificate must be installed. Not really. So the question is, what if the new certificate authority needs to be introduced? A new root certificate must be installed in all the HTTPS supported devices? Not really. Because if a new certificate authority needs to be introduced, it's gonna go to an existing root certificate. God knows what's the process. I think we're gonna go through the browser community, the browser, what is it called? Browser CA something. I forgot what the community is called. And then you get that certificate is gonna generate a private public key, and it's gonna take its public key, and the certificate authority is gonna take its public key and give it to the root certificate, and the root certificate that is existing already worldwide, trust whatever it's called. What's the one YouTube is using right now? So I can give you an example. GlobalSign, right? GlobalSign is a root certificate that is installed in every computer, right? So GlobalSign, if it trusts this new CA, let's call it, what's your name? What was your name? Cipher. Cipher. Badass name. So Cipher's CA all of a sudden takes its public key and take it to the GlobalSign, and GlobalSign takes its private key and sign your public key. And now it's a proof that this is trusted. And nobody have the private key of GlobalSign except GlobalSign. So now, if you send a request, if now you can safely generate certificate for Leaf certificate for other users. And when you get that certificate, you can just take it and then verify it using the public key, and until you reach the root certificate and you check the root certificate, does it exist on your server? Yes, trusted, no, there. Adarsh, we have Adarsh on the house. I did an interview with Adarsh. It was great, guys. Check it out. Check out the interview I did with Adarsh. I'm gonna actually just plug it right here. Let me search for it. Let me search for it. Adarsh is a great interviewer. Check his channel out. Adarsh, saying no. So let's see. There you go. Becoming a better software engineer. I'm gonna paste it right here, guys, for you. Boom. Check his channel out. So Adarsh, what did he ask? I think with the complexity with authentication nowadays, it is much easier to use a third party like Google, GitHub, or Facebook. Absolutely, absolutely agree. Authentication is very complex. That's why we needed JWT, right? But these OO services already exist. They take care of all this complexity for you. So if you can authenticate with these services, that would be the best thing, right? If you want to build your own, my God, it's complicated, right? Because especially if you have multiple servers involved, the JWT is really complicated, gonna become really complicated really quick. Thanks for the answer. You're welcome. No, Adarsh, you're great, man. Keep up the good work. Keep up the good work. Yeah. Passport is a JS library for handling auth. JWT is a token standard. Thank you, Jaden, for explaining that. Any interesting questions? How much time do we have? All right, we're gonna let's go for how about we go for another 15 minutes and then end the stream? I'm gonna set a timer because I'm very bad at timing myself. All right. I think he meant internal self-sign certificate, just secure internal backend services. I don't know what we're referring to, but self-sign certificates are rejected by default. The only self-sign certificate that are accepted are root certificates. So if you're watching this on the browser, even in a mobile, click on that lock, and then you'll see the roots, the Leaf certificate, which is this site, youtube.com, And then you will see the certificate of authority signing that. And then you see the root certificate, which is signing the certificate of authority. That's this called the certificate of trust, right? So the only self-signed is the root certificate, and it's trusted by default because it's right there on your machine. What is database seeding? Where are these terms coming from? I never heard of database seeding before, Bharat. Sorry about that. Why do you need to communicate between backend and frontend by REST API or HTTP? Why don't we just import the function or the file that does the job without any request? See, Abdulrahman, that's a great question. Why do we need to network? If you can, so your question, and I like that. I like the attitude of questioning everything. Why? Why do we need REST API? Why can't I just import the function locally? So Abdulrahman is questioning the client-server architecture. Let's see. So why did we invent the client-server architecture, guys? Who can answer this? Let's chat. Type it in the chat. I'm just going to mumble while you do. So the client-server architecture, guys, was designed for if the function that I'm about to execute is very, very expensive, then I'm offloading it to a server that has access to more resources, more CPU power. So that's one reason. The other reason is that function is querying a database with millions of users or millions of data that does not exist in my machine, and it will never exist in my machine. I cannot possibly download that database and keep it locally in my client, right? So that's another reason of using a server, that server has access to a database, right? So there are cases where you cannot import that function locally on your client. But if you can have everything locally, that will be the best thing you can do, because now everything is local. That's what Elon Musk is doing with 5G and the self-driving cars. He's trying to put as much compute at the edge in the car itself. If the car can do the compute, let it do the compute, right? So for training purposes, like if the car sees, I don't know, a kid and a traffic light and it couldn't identify it, then that picture is sent somewhere else, obviously, to train that. But imagine if you can effectively do the training unsupervised. And I'm going into AI and deep learning, which I don't have much experience in. But and if someone has, please correct me if I said anything stupid or wrong. But if I can do the training or the unsupervised training locally, asynchronously, then that's the best thing, because I can find out the result immediately. Now, how immediate? Like, if I'm about to hit a kid and I didn't know that it's a kid, that's a disaster, right? but if we can avoid that, that will be the best scenario we can need. Constanzi says, that's actually a good question. Please look up database seating if you get a chance, Hussein, and get back to us on that. Oh my God, guys, you're making me curious now. Database seeding. Seeding or seeding? Huh, how about that? It's a Wikipedia. If there's a Wikipedia entry, that means it's a legit thing. Just FYI, by the way. Because nothing usually makes it to Wikipedia without really deep, inspection. Database seeding is the initial seeding of the database with data. Seeding a database is a process in which an initial set of data is provided to a database when it's being installed. It is especially useful when we want to populate a database with data we want to develop in the future. This is often an automated process that is executed upon the initial setup of the application. The data can be dummy data. Okay, so it's just populating the data. Oh, okay, it's nothing fancy. So we're seeding the database with content, right? So whether I want to give it an SQL file when the database starts to populate itself, like especially in Docker containers, you spin a Docker container, a Postgres Docker container, it's usually empty, right?
So if you're spinning up a database Docker container that's empty, you want to populate it with data. So if you give it a huge SQL file, that's kind of seeding, I guess. Based on the definition I just read, that looks like it's seeding. Another seeding is at the application level. And now I'm making shit up, to be honest, right? Another thing is application level, where the application, the database already exists, or we spun it up somehow. Now I'm connecting to it, and I'm populating the database from the application, not the database populates itself, like the first scenario with a SQL file. Now I am actually connecting to the database, and I am inserting SQLs, and I am creating tables, and I'm creating a schema and everything. Hope that makes sense, guys. Let me know. I don't see anything much fancy about it, to be honest. But I might be wrong. Maybe I missed something. Let me know in the comment, in the chat, if I missed something. Yeah, the database seeding is inserting master data into the database. Yeah, so it's nothing fancy. But I like that they give it its own name. That's kind of nice. So you're seeding the database. How does UDP deal with packet loss since there is no ACK? It does not, Sekar. It does not. UDP does not deal with packet loss. It's the application layer responsibility to deal with packet loss. So we're going to lose the packet. If I send a UDP packet and it got corrupted, the server can, if it reached and it got corrupted, the server knows if that packet is corrupt or not. But if you send a packet that didn't reach, sorry, no way. And that's a beautiful, because you can just build at the application level all that jazz. You can just build it yourself, right? You can just build the acknowledgement. You can just build all of that. That's what Quick did. The Quick protocol did all of that, built on top of UDP. TCP is built its own thing. It's not UDP, right? It's built. And I'm glad that we had these two protocols. Otherwise, we will be in trouble with TCP. TCP is over-restrictive. That's why we had to do to build HTTP3 and Quick on top immediately of UDP, because TCP is doing a lot of dumb things that we don't want it to do, right? They are good things, but dumb for our use case. Da-da-da-da. Nokala, front-end like React developers, who is good at competitive programming to back-end engineering transaction suggestion? Anyone can be a back-end engineer. It's just a long journey. Give it 5, 6, 7, 10 years. Right, continue learning. What else? How you think? How you think we can solve the audio quality issue on WebRTC call? I wasn't aware there is an audio quality issue on WebRTC call. But if it will, that's probably if the UDP packet loss, right? So maybe you're going to use a different protocol. Again, I didn't build an audio application on top of WebRTC. But if there's a peer-to-peer and there's audio quality loss, I'm going to look at a little bit higher guarantee protocol other than UDP. UDP is great for video. I'm not sure if it translates well in the video. There is this quick feature called, I guess, lossy UDP, where it can recover an application that is just the UDP packet that is just bad, corrupted. It can actually fix it. Just started working as a software engineer. Congratulations, Kareem. Any tips? Patience. I'm turning into Gary Vee now. Patience. Just close your eyes until you're 70 years old. How was Gary Vee? Gary Vee, that was good? Was that good? Just close your eyes until you're 70. Close your eyes until 80. I'm dead by 80, Gary. If I reach 80, I'll close my eyes. Gary Vee sometimes, man. I don't know if you guys watch Gary Vee. It's just funny. I love him. Sometimes he's just funny. But yeah, software engineer tips, if you just started, just be patient, keep learning, be curious, ask why, never take anything for granted. If you see anything, question everything, whether it's a senior or a CEO, question everyone. Don't be rude, obviously, question it in yourself. If you see a technology, try to ask this question internally and try to sneak in these questions in a very diplomatic manner. But be curious. That's my goal. Stay hungry and learn everything that you can. Learn and be patient. Don't think it's a 1 year. You're not going to write your CV, oh, I have 1 year, 2 year experience. That doesn't matter. I have now over 16 years and 20 years just on professional experience, right? 4 years on professional when I started actually coding and helping people to write apps. And now 16 years actually professional working for corporate companies. And I still think I don't know a lot of stuff. People call me expert, but I don't consider myself expert. And I think this is a good, just keep working, Karim. Yeah, that's a good advice. Just keep working, keep chugging. How does callback works in promises? That's a weird question, Kumar. Callback are different than promises. Both are works exactly the same. Promises and async await is just syntactical sugar that are actually takes advantage of callbacks. I might be wrong on this one. I have $100 on Azure. I want to utilize. Is there any way I can learn about Azure and start with some backend project? I never used Azure. My company does, but I never actually spin up. Now come think about it. I never actually spend money on a cloud app. I should. And I see it's like how spin up a cloud service on AC2 and see. I need to go back, go to the cloud and see what's all the fuss about. I'm a boomer if you didn't notice. I don't have anything against the cloud. It's just I like to understand the basic first principle, because the cloud is what? Is the same thing that we're building here. It's just a name. It's all networks, it's all servers, it's everything, but it's just somewhere else, right? We just call it the cloud. Yeah. It just helps you a lot. If you want to get an application started and built, that's awesome. Just spin up something else and then take care of everything for you. That's great. If you were 21, if I were 21 years old in 2020, how would you approach software engineering? I mean, if I was 21, I'll be dumb. Because when I was 21, I was dumb. I'm still dumb. But so I would take a lot of things that are granted because I was spoiled. I think I got a lot of access to smart engineers, but I always thought myself as great, which I was obviously not, right? Once you have this self-realization, you realize if I go back and I have this knowledge that I have now, I'm going to take advantage of every engineer that are senior than me, and I squeeze all the information from them as much as possible. And I continue learning. How to switch from quantum developer. What the hell is a quantum developer? To a backend engineer. If you're a quantum developer, stay as a quantum developer. Don't come to backend engineering. It's crazy how good Telegram is. I used Telegram once. But then I switched back to WhatsApp because nobody's on Telegram. Hey, Hussein. I'm a big fan of you. I'm a big fan of you too, Pravin. Thank you so much. Appreciate you. Other application. Oh, we have 1 minute left. All right. Let's wrap up, guys. Let's wrap up. It's been a nice, beautiful stream. A beautiful stream. I like this. Do you want to continue doing this? Q&A kind of thing with coffee. My coffee's done. But do you like it? How would you like this? Or would you like the theme, coming back to a theme approach? Where we pick a topic, like a database asset, TLS, and then only answer questions within that theme. Or we keep it open like this. Today we discussed a lot of great questions, guys. You asked about microservices, you asked about NoSQL, SQL and NoSQL. I didn't answer that one, but that will take a lot of time to answer SQL versus NoSQL, so I'm not going to answer that. But yeah, guys, if you like Q&A kind of thing, maybe we'll just go with Q&A. Please continue the Q&A. Yeah, you guys love it. Why do you drink water with coffee? Because my coffee is done. I finished my coffee and I need to hydrate. Yes, okay. Looks like good. Guys, everybody likes the Q&A. All right. Maybe shorter themed video on the topic. All right. I love that. Yeah, the video, the themed one, we're going to make it into videos, like which we have already. All right. Nice, guys. All right. I joined late, so can I ask a question? Okay, Bevan, you can ask one more question. All right, we'll wait. Answer one more question, and then we'll end this. We'll end this stream because I need to be somewhere now. Right, we have 5 more minutes. Yeah, let's answer the question quickly, and then we will move on. Guys, it was really fun. When it will be next time? Saturday. Every Saturday, we stream. And I put videos in the middle of the week sometimes. All right, guys. I think I'm going to stop here. I appreciate you. Thank you so much. And I'm going to see you in the next one, guys. You guys stay awesome. Another successful stream, in my opinion. Love you so much. Thank you for your support. Thank you for watching all the videos. Thank you for your beautiful comments. Thank you for the critical comments. I appreciate you guys. I'm going to see you in the next one. You guys stay awesome. Goodbye. Bye, guys.